People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, life without friends. In a world where social connection is seen as key to a healthy and fulfilling life, what's it like living without it? And Joanna Pizzullo runs a wellness book club. She encourages readers to be critical when picking out a title, and she shares some summer reading picks. Welcome to People First Radio. Laura Eramian has been talking to people who say they have no friends. The Dalhousie prof put together a study built from interviews with 21 people from a variety of ages who all live in one Atlantic Canadian city. The thing they have in common, they all identify as having no or very few friends. In 2023, the World Health Organization declared loneliness a global public health concern. What's it like to be living without friends in a time when public messaging is telling you that it's bad for your health to do so? Eramian and her co-authors found that the friendless people they spoke to both lamented and celebrated their disconnection. I reached Laura Eramian in Halifax to break down the details.
So this is a study that I conducted with Peter Mallory of the Department of Sociology at St. Francis Xavier University in Antigonish, Nova Scotia. And we would have done this study probably between 2021 and 2022. So during the pandemic, and there were certainly some public health restrictions that shaped the way that the research took place. And I can certainly say more about that later as well. But I mean, I think the main thing to note is that there really was no single profile of a person who identified as having few or no friends. We had participants ranging from their late teens up to their 70s. Probably the majority of these people were in their 20s and 30s, I would say, just over half were in their 20s and 30s of the 21, I should say, that we spoke to. And they were, as I say, a really wide range of people. Some of them had really quite rich romantic relationships, you know, very close, intimate spousal relationships, for example, even if they lacked friends. Some of them had active professional lives. You know, some of them, you know, saw people regularly kind of, you know, in the places that they regularly went, maybe a gym or something like that, acquaintances, right? They had networks of acquaintances, but all of them for one reason or another, you know, thought that they lacked friends or what they saw as, you know, friends, if you know what I mean. And, you know, for some reasons, in some cases, that's simply because they didn't regularly encounter a lot of people. Maybe they were working from home a lot. In other cases, it was because they'd had a lot of bad friend experiences in the past and had kind of felt burned by that and had kind of given up on friendship. And in other cases, they had just, you know, they talked about how they had really decided to prioritize other things in their lives. It might have been a career, particularly for young professionals. That was a fairly common theme. Or they might have prioritized, you know, family over friends or something like that.
You said they're friends, if you know what I mean. And I think that's an important thing to address early on in the conversation. What does that mean? What is a friend?
Absolutely. So we left that open to our participants. We let them define that for us because that's part of the kind of approach that we use. We're interested in what the world looks like to ordinary people and how they make sense of, you know, whatever terminology, you know, is at hand in our work. And of course, in this case, the main theme is friendship. So, you know, we didn't have people come to us and start talking to us and we didn't say that's not a friend, right? So we let them define that for us. And of course, they had all kinds of interesting interesting ways of, you know, kind of distinguishing different kinds of friends. So, I mean, I take that phrase from some of our participants, right? Friend friends, you know, like the good, really sort of close ones. And then there's, you know, the friends that you have shared interests with that you might see for a particular activity. You know, you might have like sports team friends or something like that, right? Or work friends, of course, is a common one. So yeah, we let people tell us what a friend is rather than imposing that on them.
Reading through your study, it sounded like maybe the two biggest feelings people had were, on the one hand, this idea that I don't have friends could be lonely and distressing, and then just like thinking about the way society talks about friends or the way our culture is, it made people think like, is there something wrong with me? And then on the other hand, people were saying, well, you know, it's not so bad. You know, I don't have friends. But because of that, I am able to be autonomous. I can meet all of my own needs and I'm really self-reliant. Is that fair that those were like the two biggest things people said?
Yeah. That was kind of the tension that ran through all of the interviews. What I'd really emphasize about this is that it was not possible to sort our participants into categories of people who were lonely or not lonely because they had few or no friends. Rather, what happened out of the course of the interview is they would all kind of, you know, struggle back and forth between these two ways of thinking about having no friends. And of course, some might have emphasized one kind of, you know, set of responses over the other, but they both arose in every interview at some point. So of course, some people did emphasize that really kind of abject loneliness and suffering on account of living without friends. On the other hand, some of them really emphasized that idea that, you know, I can do whatever I want. And, you know, there aren't any sorts of, you know, commitments that I have and, you know, my time is my own and I can pursue my own, you know, hobbies or interests or what have you, which was unexpected, I would say. We did not expect to find that. And of course, key to this, I think, is that we recruited friendless rather than lonely people. Right. If we had recruited lonely people, we would have missed this opportunity to learn about this other kind of narrative behind what it means to live without friends.
So having done this work, being in the field you're in, if I just throw casually the words loneliness epidemic at you, what's your first reaction?
Well, I mean, I think my first reaction is there's certainly there's something very real about that, but it's not the only story. I guess it's maybe more complicated than we often make it out to be, because people have different ways, as I say, of responding to solitude. And there's lots of research that shows that people can give different kinds of meanings to experiences of solitude, and they aren't all negative. On the other hand, though, I mean, certainly there are transformations in our world that have made loneliness and concerns about it particularly kind of acute lately, I would say. And of course, interestingly, I don't think it's the only historical moment where that's happened. I think anytime, you know, scholars have shown that anytime there's sort of a big technological change, people kind of panic and think like this is going to, you know, fragment you know, social connections and what have you. You know, the advent of television was similarly feared, right? But of course, we have a very particular kind of historical and cultural moment we're living in now. And I think that those concerns about, you know, what social media does and, you know, the way that it divides people, you know, as much as it brings them together, perhaps, those are not, you know, concerns that we should take lightly.
At some point in the paper, you talked about the idea that maybe a friendship as we think about it today is kind of like a relatively recent phenomenon in human history. And that really interested me. Could you tell me more?
Yeah. So anthropologists and sociologists who work on these kinds of issues have shown that the way that at least, you know, kind of modern Euro-American friendship, I should be very clear on that, you know, friendship is thought about and configured in very different ways cross-culturally. But modern Euro-American friendship, scholars argue, is made possible by a series of very particular kinds of historical transformations, especially things like, you know, the rise of impersonal societies communities of strangers, right? You don't sort of have, small face-to-face communities anymore, where you kind of, you get who you get, and you probably have, kinship relations to a lot of people, historically in a smaller scale kind of community. And, for the first time, people have this, apparent anyway, this is debated in the literature, the degree to which friendship really is fully chosen. People have a much wider ranges of choice in terms of, who they can befriend. So that's the thinking behind this. So as soon as you have the rise of kind of urban societies of, large populations, friendship is possible, the kind of way that we think about friendship now. Anyway, because people can choose each other rather than need each other, if I can make that distinction.
And yet a number of the people you spoke to, I guess it seemed like they didn't choose or need a lot of people in any case.
Well, that's so interesting, right? I mean, I guess I should be clear. We tried not to make any assumptions when we conducted these interviews. So we tried not to assume that everyone who didn't have friends was unhappy with that. So we did ask a question at some point in the interview to determine, if they were in any way friendless by choice. And it was the responses to that question that largely brought out that second kind of narrative you mentioned earlier about, in part I chose this for myself because, I value my self-reliance and my autonomy and that kind of thing. And the sidebar was kind of always, I'd prefer to have friends, but in the absence of some really good ones, I'd prefer my own company. That was often the kind of story that we got. And I mean, I think a big part of this, what we argued, in some of the work that we've written up, is that, and I think you mentioned this in the outset, people kind of know that it's a difficult thing to be friendless in our society today, with all the talk of how friendship is valued and essential to good lives and, to our, human connection and that kind of thing. There can be a real stigma around that. And so people feel a real need to justify their friendlessness and to try to find some dignity in it. And they did that, as you mentioned, by relying on that highly valued set of North American kind of, cultural values around, autonomy and freedom and self-reliance.
And in the paper about this, you wrote that you can wonder if there's a distress signal that says something disquieting about modern life in participants' claims that they valued being friendless.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a term we borrow from the sociologist Alison Pugh, who wrote a fabulous book called The Tumbleweed Society. It wasn't about friendship so much as about cultures of work and care work. But what she argued is that, when people assert that something is a choice when it never can fully quite be, in somewhere in there is a distress signal, and it tells us something about, maybe the broader ways that our society is organized that make it hard for people to forge meaningful connections with each other, regardless of the choices they make personally.
And again, on that idea that this was something that people maybe felt like they needed to defend, apparently people also were bringing up the idea of loneliness before it came up in the conversation as part of a question.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, as I say, we did have direct questions, about the extent to which and, sort of the frequency with which they felt lonely, if at all, on account of living without friends. But yeah, a lot of people brought it up before we asked those questions. And so it certainly was something that weighed on a lot of our participants and something that they wanted to raise even before we came to it.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. We're talking about friendlessness and loneliness. Laura Eramian with Dalhousie University led a study that interviewed 21 people in Atlantic Canada, all of whom identified as having no or few friends. That study was published in the Canadian Journal of Sociology, and if you're curious, you can find it online. We'll include a link in the show notes of the podcast version of this episode. You also included some direct quotes from your study, from the interviews. A few of them, I've got to say, hit me pretty hard. There was one, I know you mentioned that a lot of different demographics kind of made up your study group. There was an older retired gardener who talked about, like, he just stopped taking his prescriptions for months on end because he didn't have a doctor. And he said something along the lines of, if I don't have anyone to talk to or whatever, like, what's the point of taking prescriptions?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the tougher ones for sure. I remember that fellow, you know, crystal clearly, speaking to him in my office. Yeah, he was certainly one of the people we spoke with who was suffering the most on account of living without friends. And, you know, for him, it was such a difficult thing because, you know, he felt like he had chosen the wrong people in the past. And that was a common kind of narrative we heard too. People were often kind of torn between this idea that, you know, is the problem me? You know, am I choosing the wrong people or is there just something wrong with, you know, our broader society or with other people, right, in terms of their character or something like that. So that's certainly something that people were grappling with.
And do you think that comes down to the idea you were talking about earlier of now there's this idea that I can sort of choose my friends, I can take whatever super niche hobby I'm into, look for someone on the internet who does it as well, and we can become best pals. Whereas if I was living in some other age, I might have to be like, well, these are the 12 people who live near me, gotta make the best of it.
Well, yeah. And I think you've pointed to something that's maybe even, you know, really more important about this. You know, so much of modern identity doesn't come anymore from what we call in the social sciences, you know, statuses and roles. So, you know, those positions you have in the social structure, you know, it might be a kinship position, it might be an age position, it might be occupational, and the associated roles that go along with that. We, of course, still have all of that. But so much of modern identity is beyond that. It's about, you know, who we are sort of as at the core as individuals, regardless of whether we're parents or whether, you know, we're, you know, working minimum wage jobs or if we're physicians or what have you, right? People think of themselves as, you know, individuals with identities and forms of selfhood that exceed all of those things that we are or are not, maybe. And so what that means is that what you're not chosen as a friend, you know, given that, you know, we can think of friendship as a chosen, perhaps, rather than a given bond, like, you know, a sibling bond that you don't get to choose, something like that. It feels extra personal, right? To not be chosen in that way, in the sense that people often choose their friends on the basis of mutual liking, or seeing something really interesting about the other person, something they want to get to know better. So when you're not, you know, being, you know, chosen as a friend by other people for whatever reason, that can feel, you know, extremely hurtful and can really make you question your sense of self. That was something that really did come out in our interviews as well.
And this goes back to that idea of, it's not just that you're missing out on whatever the benefits of having friends are if you're friendless. It's that there's this whole stigma and, like, reason to kind of get in your head about what's going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we did ask a question toward the end of the interview that tried to get at, you know, how people thought others see them. It's sort of an awkward question to ask, you know, because you're asking them to sort of put themselves in the viewpoint of other people looking at themselves. But yeah, so often, you know, it was not positive stuff, right? People would say, oh, you know, people look down on people like me. People think there's something wrong with us. They think that, you know, we're misanthropic and we hate everybody. Or, you know, we're lonely cat ladies. Someone referenced Oscar the Grouch, I think, you know, things like that. They had very sort of clear and overwhelmingly negative types of ideas about how they were seen. Hence, yeah, the stigma problem.
One anecdote from the paper that I thought was kind of fun almost in a way was that you talked to someone, an older person, who said yeah, like I'm pretty fine with this, but I've heard a lot of stats that loneliness is really bad for your health and that I might not live as long. And like, is that true? Maybe I should make some friends.
Yeah. So that was what was another really interesting finding with this study. Even people who, you know, I think quite genuinely felt reasonably at ease with their friendlessness, they hear, you know, we all hear these stories that circulate, you know, in popular media. You know, the government is telling us to go out and make friends for our health. You know, doctors might be, therapists certainly do, right? And this circulates, you know, kind of in popular conversations. So even when people are relatively at ease with their solitude, they can still worry, you know, if there couldn't be some ill health effects. Of course, our study is not one that, you know, the nature of our data cannot shed light on that kind of question. So unfortunately, I was not able to answer that gentleman's question about the ill effects on his health one way or the other. But, you know, it is definitely a story that circulates and that people are concerned about, regardless of how they, you know, feel personally about their lack of friends.
What do you think the consequences are of that narrative?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, in part, I suppose it depends on, you know, if there really is strong evidence, and it's still up for debate, right? I mean, obviously the causes of, you know, mortality and morbidity are some very complex combination of social and environmental and hereditary and all kinds of factors. So it's hard for us to sort of, you know, pinpoint, you know, having no friends is the thing that has caused your health problems, right? So in part, it kind of hinges on the veracity of that, I guess. But on the other hand, it certainly gives somebody, it gives people kind of another thing to fixate and worry about potentially, right? And kind of to reflexively monitor in their lives all the time. You know, do I have enough social connections? Am I seeing people often enough? And as much as that advice, I think, is well-intentioned, it can have that kind of unexpected side effect of increasing pressure on people in a way, and putting pressure on themselves, you know, to increase their connections. And another thing to worry about potentially if they're not, you know, seeing a lot of people regularly, perhaps.
I'm thinking as you say that, you know, like individual people aren't population level statistics, and probably a ton of different people are going to have a ton of different reactions. Like there are probably a lot of people who would be very prone to thinking about that narrative that you're saying and like wondering, does this impact me? And there would probably be other people who absolutely would not give it a second thought. I'm wondering how, when you approach this, even the study is like, we interviewed 21 people in Atlantic Canada who say they don't have a lot of friends. How do you approach saying, okay, well, we talked to these 21 people, now here's what we're going to do with that and try and like generalize about it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, what I always tell my students when I'm teaching them methods, you know, like the ones that we use, you know, so not statistical methods that are going to be representative of some larger population. We never aim at that. It's in what we call qualitative research, which is the kind of research that we've done in this study. Qualitative research is interested in, you know, well, the ways people interpret their lives and the meanings that they give to things, and you know, kind of, I guess, depth rather than breadth of the population, if you know what I mean. And the way that we can generalize with that, you're absolutely right. We can't take these 21 people and say that they somehow represent, you know, one city or region or let alone a country. But what we can do is we can notice that they all kind of rely on the same types of interpretations. And we can then kind of figure out what some of the larger cultural stories are that they're drawing on. So we generalize kind of in a conceptual way, in a theoretical way, rather than in a statistical kind of way. So, you know, when it tells us something, for example, it's not totally idiosyncratic if 21 people all rely on the same types of broader stories about what it means to be friendless, because they're circulating all around us, as I say. And so we can kind of figure out what those stories are that people are drawing on to make sense of their own lives and how the world looks to them. That's our real aim with this.
And we've talked about those stories over the last 25 minutes or so. Some of them have been that sometimes people are talking about, you know, I am lonely. Sometimes people are talking about, I am really self-reliant because of this. A lot of people are wondering, like, am I doing something wrong? Is there something wrong with me? Should I have more friends? We've talked about this idea that health professionals, certainly maybe governments and therapists are really pushing this idea that we need to have more friends. So these narratives have emerged. What do you think we need to do with them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I suppose, you know, I suppose one of the findings of our work is that people can put these narratives to different uses, right? In our case, it's about trying to make sense of or justify a state of social disconnection. But I guess as far as the broader implications of these findings, I guess what we would emphasize is that it might not get us very far, you know, if we're interested maybe in enabling friendship, you know, helping people build connections, you know, who are interested in doing so. It's never going to really help to just sort of look to individuals and tell them, you know, sort of go out and make friends, okay? Because as we've argued in the paper and elsewhere, friendship is just like any other social relationship. It can be either enabled or constrained by the broader ways that our society is organized. And some of the things that our participants reported indicate that it's not really about them and their choices. It's about the larger things that they're subject to that might prevent them from being able to go out and make friends. So, for example, if you're not making a lot of money, it's hard to say, like, go and meet people for dinner. It costs money, obviously, to go out and eat or to go to a sports event. Maybe, you know, there's tickets involved or something like that. So we would ask, you know, are there enough free and inclusive public spaces where people can gather, you know, at no cost, where it would be possible to make and sustain friendships? We would also be interested in the ways that, especially, you know, people starting out in their careers, and of course, not just younger people, lots of different kinds of people, they might have like really rigid but also unpredictable work schedules that make it really hard to make or keep plans with anybody. And so, again, these are beyond the choices that people make for themselves about whether to connect or not. And so, as social scientists, we're always interested in those broader ways that, you know, our society is organized and how that affects, you know, these individual stories that we hear.
I'm really interested in the idea that was sort of an undertone there of you can't just make it about the individual. You can't say, like, you have no friends and this is because of some choice you've made, or like this is a personal failing of yours. That was something that you kind of feel like emerges from your research?
Absolutely, yeah. Because as I say, I mean, as much as, particularly in North American society, we like to think of ourselves as kind of, you know, free agents who are unencumbered. We can do what we want. People only have themselves to blame if things go wrong. They only have themselves to thank if they're successful. But we all live in, you know, societies that are structured in particular ways, you know, that are characterized by all kinds of patterns of privilege and marginalization. And we don't often think of friendship as something that is patterned that way. But the literature really does show that friendship can be more or less accessible to different kinds of people, depending on the degree of leisure time that they have. And of course, what gives leisure time is wealth, more than anything else. If you're not struggling to, you know, make ends meet and that kind of thing. So we have to think of friendship, if we're going to be good social scientists about it, that is, we have to think of friendship as never just the choice to, you know, connect with somebody that you find, you know, interesting or likable. You also have to think about the conditions that make those connections possible or that, you know, pose barriers to them.
Laura or Aramian, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
Laura Aramian is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.